he comes to the conclusion there isn't any choice. And he thought that the sage is, by his wisdom, completely circumscribed in action. And of course that corresponds with what lots of mystics have said about the wise man, that he is the most circumscribed of all men, that he has no choice because he knows too much. Now, like every other statement, this could be true and also could mislead an individual into thinking that he himself has no choice and is therefore merely a mechanism. If an individual is merely a mechanism, whatever he does, including breaking down or running on indefinitely. And if it is perfectly true that men are mechanisms only, then the combination of letters C-H-O-I-C-E isn't a word at all. Because a word we have defined as a sound with intended significance. Now the word, if it is a word, choice, must refer to some concept we have. And if it refers to nothing at all, it isn't a word. So we have to say either that that combination of letters constituting choice is not a word, or if it is a word, it signifies something, and therefore it has a referent, and therefore there is choice. We then have to decide just precisely what choice is. And we'll consider it a little in the form of a triangle, like Karl Marx might have done. And we'll say there is A here, and not A here, on the baseline. Now let's imagine a beam, for a moment, like a billiard ball, that was entirely X. X is an unknown quality which we won't define, but we will say that this being is entirely X. Absolutely throughout, essentially totally X. There is no non-X in it. Now every being knows only the modifications of its own substance. It cannot know anything unless its substance itself can vibrate in that manner. So if this is totally X, it can only know X. That is, its whole being is being X. So if there is an entity non-X, it must remain forever unknown by X. So if we get a perfectly unific being, a being totally X, and there is another being, we'll do noughts and crosses, we'll call it O. This other being, in its characteristic vibrations, could never convey to X precisely what it was. So for X, there can be no choice. So that for any being which is essentially a unity, throughout itself identical, choice is impossible. Because choice means determining between alternatives. And an essentially unific being has no alternatives. It is simply being itself. Now, as soon as we introduce duality into a being, and we'll give it a quality X and another quality O, then straight away this being can respond to a stimulus X by sympathy, by resonance, and become aware that there is a like entity outside itself. And it can respond to O in the other part of its being. And therefore the whole being has two things presented to it at once. But again, the X factor, the X part of its being, has no choice but to respond to X. And the O part of its being has no choice but to respond to O. So it is a peculiar being, it is a being the parts of which have no choice, and yet which itself as a whole being has alternative courses of action which constitute choice. Nevertheless, when these stimuli come to the order X and O to this complex being, when the stimuli come they force a reaction in the substance, and thus the content of consciousness is again mechanically determined. So there is no choice about whether you receive or do not receive the stimulus. Now, choice is determining between alternatives. And we've seen that if a being is totally X, it cannot choose at all. And if it is X and O, then it cannot choose X with the O or O with the X. And yet it has the possibility of responding in two ways, which is the ground of the possibility of choice. Now, if we were to try to solve the problem in this way, we could not solve it, because we would circumscribe our attention. We would be fixed on a finite. Now, every finite is necessarily a machine. That is to say, every finite that we can consider, by the fact that it is finite, circumscribed, limited, can be determined in some way by an external stimulus. And the way it will react to that stimulus is determined by the nature of the stimulus and the nature of the finite being stimulated. So the reaction is mechanical. So as long as we are considering finites in this manner, we can never solve the problem of choice. There can't be any. Because the stimulus and the receiving body reaction are determined by their own qualities. So if we make a finite analysis, choice is impossible. So no matter how big we make the circle, it is still a machine. When we find the mystic Jacob Burma talking about the universe as a watch made of parts, springs, wheels, and so on, he means that. And nevertheless, he knows that free spirit also is considered by human consciousness. So when we draw a circle, we pretend it's a big circle there is. The fact that it is a circle means that it is closed, finite. And beyond that finite, there is the infinite. And as every finite is a machine, choice cannot be in the finite. But choice is always between alternatives. So if we make this point of the triangle, A, the centre of the circle, and the point of the centre of another circle, then we have two circles here, the zones of influence of A and not A, and somewhere on the line there, between them, is a zone which is neither A nor not A. Now obviously this isn't Aristotelian, because according to Aristotle, everything must either be A or not A. Every finite must either be of a certain quality or not. So that as soon as you confine yourself to the finites, you are pinned in a mechanism, and choice becomes impossible. But because choice is always between alternatives, then we must go between finites to find the ground of choice. And we're going to put at the top, there is A there and not A there, and we're going to put A, not A, simultaneously at the top. And we'll use this top point of the triangle, the apex of the triangle, simply to focus ourselves so that we can go down to right and left to consider A and not A in separativity. In the absolute, beyond the limiting factors, whatever it is at the level of finite that we call A and not A, must be asserted simultaneously. The absolute is A, not A. This is what we mean by non-dualism. It isn't one, which is either A or not A. And it isn't two, namely A and not A, the dualism. It is neither A nor not A. It is prior to the designation A and not A. A is already a form for consideration. Not A is another form, which negates the first. To become free, we must become completely uncircumscribed. To become free, we must identify with nothing whatever. And in order to get to that point, we must first have a concept of freedom, which itself is a finite. Because every concept is finite. What we find, in fact, is that at the level of human beings, some human beings push other human beings about. Babies are picked up, put into prams, and inverted and dusted, generally maltreated by other beings called adults. Now the adult is actually able to do this on the baby. So we recognize forces that are higher and forces that are lower. And the higher forces act on the lower. And the word choice means this, that a force from above is applying itself to some forces below. The mere fact that this can happen starts an infinite regression. If we find a baby in the pram, which has not yet been able to sit up and tear its ribbons from under its chin, and is just lying there goo-eyed, we may find another baby, 4 or 5 years old, big enough to come and hit it with a bat, when its mother's not looking. And then we find perhaps a larger boy to hit the boy with the bat, and then perhaps that larger boy has a father who comes and hits him. And this gives us an idea that somewhere above there is an ultimate big power that can hit everybody. Now this ultimate big power is moving in the direction of an infinite regression. So we can say the term of the concept is infinite power itself. Now this infinite power must be able to determine the behavior of all finites. And nothing less than the infinite can be free from the finite. What is bound in the finite is a machine. Insofar as a man identifies with a finite body, he is determined by the law governing that body. Insofar as he refuses to identify with any finite situation, he remains free from it. So to be free, one must not identify with a finite. So in the pursuit of choice, we have to, in practical terms, practice non-identification with finites. And if you wish to identify at all, do it with nothing. Nothing being equatable with the free. If you identify with the dome, then you are circumscribed. And according to the characteristics you invest in the dome, so your behavior will be determined. If you wish to become free, you must learn to control dome. Dome is another way of saying definition. A governing concept. Once it is inserted in your mind, if it is of a higher order than the existing concept, it will begin to push about those concepts in the mind. An idea is not nothing. It is a modal power. It is an operation of the absolute within the absolute. And every idea has a certain amount of power, is a certain amount of power, is itself sentient. Remember, we must not be dualistic. The absolute is intelligent power, sentient power, causative power. So, a concept is not nothing. A concept is a definite amount of spiritual energy, intelligent and sentient. Therefore, it will push other ideas about of a lower order. So, if you put an idea in a man's mind, even through the ears, once that idea is in, it will battle with other ideas of a lower order, whether you like it or not. Because to be non-dualistic, that idea is itself describable, therefore finite, and therefore a packet of sentient energy pursuing its own purpose. So to liberate an idea is to liberate a force which will fight against other forces to establish itself. And the higher force in operation, ordering the lower forces, is said to be the choosing force. And the lower forces are chosen. Now, one of the things in Christian theology that's difficult is this idea of the election of grace, of predestination. So, it is said that men of themselves can do nothing. And therefore they cannot save themselves, and therefore they're entirely dependent on grace. Now, misunderstood by people identified with their gross physical bodies, this means that no man could possibly help himself. He's got to wait for grace to come to him. But if he waits for grace to come to him, he's being a dualist, because he's postulating there is a force called grace other than himself. And grace is the same as grace and free, which isn't the devil, it's the free. The man who wishes to have grace must first realize that he has it, and he must use it. Grace is the free in himself. That is the highest concept he has, which is ordering him about, is actually the grace that frees the others. And it frees them from false associations with other low-level concepts and binds them simultaneously to other concepts in a proper context. Freedom is bondage. You were going to say something.
I was going to ask you about this question of grace. It's appeared to me when I've read about men that have produced theories and things like that, that they have used up all the energy at one particular level before the higher level has come in, which would appear to be grace. Is this so? For instance, Einstein said that when he got his original ideas, he worked until he could work no longer, and then it suddenly came to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that he must have used up one level of energy before the other level of energy, which gave him the, what he would describe as grace, came forward. Would that be so?
Well, consider it this way. Einstein was identified by his education with a given problem. He had a number of finite concepts of physics given to him by his education. He wasn't a Hottentot. He was a Yiddish gentleman with a certain education. Now, those ideas mechanically worked themselves round, and because of the nature of finites, they worked in a circle, so that they could not possibly discover for him the idea he wanted, because all logic is tautological. His education determined the direction of the problem and also the fact that it could not be solved. Now, you know that if you take any substance whatever, we'll take a little kiddie's circular railway, the first one you get that annoys you when you're a little boy, one four-piece circle of track, and you put the train on it and it goes round and round and round and bores you in about 4 minutes, and you want a bigger track, then more bending. If you put the train on the track, keep winding it up and letting it run out, it will wear the rails out. And when it's worn the rails out, then it will drop. In the same way, any substance whatever, if you run energy through it, will gradually wear itself out. You can actually wear out in the brain certain associations of ideas by simply repeating them over and over again. At a certain point they become meaningless. You can try this with your own name or with anything whatever. Suddenly the thing becomes quite meaningless. Its stimulus is gone. This is like the train running round the rails and wearing the rails out and then falling through. Now, the kind of process Einstein and other thinkers go through is precisely that. They have this idea, and this idea is searching for another idea. But it is searching in a circle on a track. And it runs round and round and round looking for that marvellous invention. And it exhausts the person who is doing the thinking and literally wears him out. And then it falls through. And this is the point when it falls through where the grace operates. Another concept of which he was totally unaware is now seen to be there. And it is related to the problem he tried to solve, because it was the governing concept that set that problem for the human race. Einstein is the end result of a lot of thinkers. I say end result up to now, because there will be more Einsteins in the future who will tear to bits what he said. Nevertheless, he's the, or was up to his death a couple of years ago, the end result of a long evolution of ideas. He didn't determine the problem. The problem determined his behaviour. That problem wore him out, and when he was exhausted and cut to pieces with the problem, then the problem fell through and left a hole. Through that hole, light shines. Suddenly he sees a relation that he couldn't see before because he could see the particulars on the surface.
Is that the process of grace?
That is one of the processes of grace. And that is, you might call that the hard way.
Yeah.
First assume that it's possible to solve the thing finitely, and you are deceived. Then you will work very, very hard until the bottom falls out of your market. And then you'll suddenly see a bigger idea than the one you started with, and you'll say, why didn't I see that before? It's so simple. Einstein's unifield theory is very, very simple. Why haven't people seen it before? The answer is, people cannot see anything by definition. People can't. Mystics have seen the unifield long before Einstein, but they were called mystics. You see, logicians saw it long before Einstein, but they weren't empirical scientists. Philosophers saw it, but again, they weren't scientists. And as it happens to be a period of science, only scientists can think correctly. Actually, they're completely circumscribed by the historic evolution of the period. It is the zeitgeist, the time spirit, that determines the next problem for science. So they're entirely mechanical about that. Then the higher force that suddenly presents itself when the rotating energy has cut a hole in the substance of that man appears to him as grace. But that higher force is part of a higher mechanism, right up to the top big circle. And on the outside of that, there is only immediacy, which is spirit itself. Now that spirit itself penetrates all the things that can be possibly discovered by man, and it penetrates them immediately. But most of the things it has to say are anachronistic. They're out of joint for the time, because the people at the level of the time process can't see further than the historic evolute allows them to. So to tell them a certain thing, that there is something beyond, say, the speed of light is a top constant. To say that is to stagger most minds. Some scientists today are just beginning to nibble. I think there may be something of a totally other order to the physical world, where light is not the top energy of the universe, but the bottom energy of another universe above it. The light is a substance, but it's a substance belonging in the spiritual world, standing in relation to the free spirit, as the gross body does to the mind of a man. The light is substance. Now that will be considered today by most people mystical. There are a few scientists, the avant-garde, who actually feel, think, that is said, they're aware of deficiencies of the existing thought process. They feel there's something wrong with the thinking, and they have a general direction that somehow we are living in a universe which is inside another universe. The gross universe is inside a subtle universe, all the elements of which are idea events. And beyond that, there is another universe, the universe of causes, which is pure powers. These powers are driving in to formulate the subtle universe, which precipitates the gross universe. And the absolute itself contains all these. And only this infinite absolute is free, absolutely. But all the others below it are free relatively to the ones below. And they are bound to the ones above. Now when we talk about necessity, we are talking about the not ceasingness of characteristic motions. Supposing we say necessity means not ceasing. So we say a thing is necessary which is not ceasing in its characteristic mode. It is an unceasing motion which we cannot conceive ever to be other than it is. A power is behaving in a certain way and it is behaving unceasingly in this characteristic way, and this unceasingness is what we call necessity. Now, the general idea of necessity would be opposed to the idea of choice. So if there is anything necessary whatever about the absolute, then there would be no choice in the absolute. Now, suppose when we look at the absolute and consider it as power, the essential nature of which is motion, absolute motion. Now, not relative motion, because relative motion is the motion of finite bodies to each other, measured from a certain viewpoint. Absolute motion is that which you approximate to when you try to conceive all finite motions simultaneously, and then make an allowance for your incapacity to conceive it. This absolute motion, therefore, is not finitely characterized at all, and therefore is not finitely determined, and therefore is able to choose in the field of the finites. All the finites are below it. Itself is pure dynamism, pure intelligent sentient motion power. It determines, sets the end term of its own operations. There is nothing other than it to constrain it. So that what it does from itself. Not from something else. Because it does it from itself and not from something else, we say it acts immediately. That is, without mediation. And when it acts immediately to produce a form, as soon as it has produced the form, it has produced something finite and therefore immediate. Because now, when it tries to operate through that finite to make another one, the first finite is the mediator between the absolute and the second finite produced.
When you get these concepts of modalities of power, and you're getting new concepts handed down to you, you've already had contingent relations, and there are already certain ideas in your mind, and new ideas coming in are bound to create a battle inside you for a time, aren't they?
Necessarily. By the unceasing motion that constitutes those ideas. As soon as you put two ideas together, a conflict starts. If you don't know that, you can become crazy. And I mean crazy.
Yes.
If you do know it, you merely recognize that two ideas are now reorientating themselves to each other. And you can say, how very amusing. How fantastic. I must write a poem about it. Or a novel. But if you think for one moment, being identified with them, that they represent you, you must be confused. You must be at war with yourself. And this is to be dualistic. Because you cannot be at war with yourself unless you're a dualist. If you're a non-dualist, whatever war there is, it doesn't belong to you. It belongs in the conceptual realm. There was a little underground bull on the TV last night. I don't know if you saw it. And because it wasn't big enough, they said, we must destroy it. It doesn't conform to government speculation for bull size. Now, the interviewer was discussing this, and the man with the bull was saying what he thought about it, what the government think about bulls as not proper bulls, and so on. And the bull itself just looked like a bull. It wasn't bothered by this exchange of concepts. But it was aware that there was some slight feeling of agitation on the part of its owner. And when there was a suggestion that, as it was such a little bull, it should be destroyed, or if not destroyed, emasculated, so that it couldn't get into government stock and make small cows, it felt something of the agitation of its owner. And it did a few little head shakes and pulled it. But it didn't know what formally it was pulling about. Now, people as such are at the level of being aware that there is something to be solved without being able to define what it is. In the Old Testament it says, my beloved turtle doves of the people. Tor is Hebrew for a turtle dove. And the dove is the figure of the reproductive entity that goes about cooing all day long. So the people who supply the bodies or vehicles of experience in the world are said to be beloved by God because they keep the machinery going. They provide vehicles of experience. And they're doing a good job. They're like the produce in 1984. They enjoy themselves. The bosses enjoy themselves at the top because they know the ropes. But in the middle level, they don't enjoy themselves. They're terrified of being mistaken for turtle doves, and they haven't got enough savage to belong to the top lot. They don't drink beer. They drink martinis. Whatever they do is conditioned by fear of falling below and inability to climb above. So in that mid-region, there is a perpetual scramble for security, for stability, for recognition. Now, if beings are to gain freedom, that is the ability freely to determine their own modes, they must get hold of this non-identification with finite. To identify with the finite is to go under the law governing the finite. If you think you are an Englishman and you go abroad, perhaps you go into the Congo or something, and you are recognized as a white man, at a certain moment, at a certain time, you might get punched in the nose simply for identifying yourself as a white man from Europe. If you had enough savvy, you would make friendly gestures and represent yourself as one who had always fought for the Negro freedom. And if you did so, you might escape. You might even get a decoration. The important thing is, if you have a higher concept than the people with whom you deal, you are free from the things that determine their activity. Now, this repetition of the necessity for non-identification, we hope, is boring. Because what we want to do is bore a hole, like the little train running around its track. We want it to bore right through, so the whole bottom drops out of the necessity for identification with finites, and leaves the man free to dome himself. So far, every child that is born into the world is conditioned by its educators, by its environment. It's something to be born an Englishman and not a Hottentot. It's something to be born in Russian and not a member of the USA. Conceptually, the man is determined by it. You've seen how concepts in New York recently made some very disgusting behaviour in Khrushchev's visit. An apology is made and said that bad behaviour is the product of refugees and not of Native Americans. This isn't strictly true. Nevertheless, there's a certain measure of it, but those refugees have been conditioned, conceptualized by experiences they've had in Europe, possibly in Russia. So that when they think of Russia, certain passions arise in them, and they are determined mechanically by these concepts and they hit out. If you saw any of them in the newsreel, you see a purely animal expression, ready to destroy what in effect is a man come over to talk business. That kind of thing won't do. The business of the statesman is the business of the man who understands the states into which people get, geographically, politically, socially, psychologically, is this. He must manipulate those states, and he can only do so by a higher concept. There's a difference between a politician and a statesman. A politician is concerned with managing the affairs of the city. Politics is to do with the city. But the statesman is concerned with managing the affairs as conditioned by states, in its very widest sense. The states of the earth, seasonal changes, those are states. States of the different latitudes and longitudes of the earth, those are states. National states and so on are simply the resultants and the index of geographical states which determine. You know, if the earth were a perfect sphere with a perfectly plain surface, the water now on it would distribute itself equally all over it, and there would be no land, and therefore no land animals. the fact that through shrinkage and earthquakes and so on, the earth is wrinkled, so is that mountain ranges. And these occur on certain latitudes and longitudes according to the stresses and strains on the original sphere. This fact determines from the mountains when the rain falling on the mountains runs down the courses of rivers. That determines in its journey towards the lowest level, the sea level, where the deltas will meet, the mouths of the rivers. This determines the carrying down of the mud and the creation of fertile plains in the region of river mouths. And this determines the possibility of agriculture. This determines the growth of cities, of men. So that the collection of men in specific places is again a resultant of states of natural elements, states of the earth. Men that understand those things are statesmen. Men that don't understand those determinants cannot be statesmen, but they may be politicians. The essence of a statesman is he's not governed merely by temporal expediency, born out of topical events, whereas the politician is governed by such things. To become free, we have to get this concept that freedom itself means the determination of a mode from within, that means, instead of from without. If we try in any other way to get it, we will fail. If we don't know what it means, we can't have it. You've seen them running about in the Congo, lots of black people hitting each other, scrabbling for power, rather than behind the time, because this kind of scrabble, identical with it, was done in Europe 1,000 years ago. And in this scramble for power, we see no evidence of careful, reasoned thought. But not a smooth transition. Britain was very cunning. It trained a lot of Negroes as lawyers, as doctors, and in the various professions for many years to get them ready so that it could put those men in position before it turned over the government of the country. Belgians, who hadn't thought so far ahead, suddenly became afraid that the African states who had been given their liberty would inspire other African peoples to demand liberty, panicked, and then threw the ball to the Africans, who had not been trained, were no lawyers there, no doctors in sufficient numbers and so on, to take over the country. The result is a kind of civil war. Now, you cannot be free except from something. Free from. So there must be some finite situation from which you free yourself. And this finite situation you must define properly. And this you can only do by climbing above it and looking at the finites in the light of a higher concept. Now that triangle of relation is similar to the pyramid. There's a hierarchy of concepts. On the very lowest level, sense percepts. The action of your five senses giving you data. On the next level, those data are grouped together to produce what are called general ideas. If we get a percept of a Dachshund and an Alsatian and a Great Dane and a Whippet and so on, out of all these we produce a general idea of dog. Now this general idea enables us to control the dogs in a certain way. We know that the tail wagger's association is determined by the wagging of the tail of the dog. Those who worship wagging tails that wag and show signs of pleasure are really dependent on the tail wagging. They're not free. So the large numbers of people who belong to the tail waggers are really determined by this wagging tail. The doggy runs towards and wags his tail. The owner of said dog feels immediately valuable. The doggy is recognizing my value. Therefore, I will buy it a medal. Now, this isn't free from tail wagging, but it may be free from cats who don't wag their tails. So, in order to determine free, you must determine from what. It will always be a finite situation. The more accurately you define it, the freer you will be from it, because of this fact. consciousness itself can never become a finite. The man identified with the situation is a machine. If his consciousness is considered by him to go only so far, no further, then he will respond at that level. If he is aware of the defined situation, he immediately becomes aware that he is not the situation. You can see this perfectly obviously in emotional people, in children at a certain age. When they're emotionally identified with a situation, they cannot logically stand back. This is one of the things that young love doesn't like. A young fellow introduced me to a girl a few years ago. He was 18, this girl was 17. He thought she was marvellous, she was terrific. He asked me what I thought about her. And I said, I would rather not say she looked like a girl to me. Now, he was injured when I said she looked like a girl. She should have looked marvellous, she should have looked terrific. He was in a certain state of undefinition. Now, a few years have passed. Already he has had defined for him certain little characteristics that did not first show. And as these definitions sharpen, so he becomes freer from the object. Not that he wants to be free. He says he's disappointed. The object is becoming progressively clearer. As it becomes clearer, the circle round it becomes tighter and harder. And consciousness cannot consider itself identical with a properly, clearly defined concept, because it can always see beyond the edge. Consciousness can only be confused if you rub out the edges. So at the feeling level of consciousness, identification is easier to fall into and more dangerous. But at the intellectual end, where definition becomes progressively sharper, identification becomes less and less. And this is why people in a romantic mood don't like to have the situation defined. If you define it, most people admit this and have gone through it, if you define it, the emotion dies down. And then the emotion is so pleasant. Why kill it? And if you allow the emotion to run on, it runs you with your head in a noose.
Still retain the value of the feeling
then? Well, initially you can't. First of all, you start as a little baby, you're dependent. Somebody feeds you. And you believe, funnily enough, that you have magical power over the food supply. The baby that screams when it wants feeding and suddenly finds a nipple in its mouth believes it has caused the nipple to appear in its mouth by screaming magically. And so, if it isn't disillusioned of this, it will simply scream its way through life. When it goes into these emotional conditions, it will require experience, pain, punishment, before it will gradually realize it wasn't the screaming that caused the feeling, it was an instinct in the mother, from the same source as its own suffering instinct, that caused the mother to supply it. Gradually, it is abstracted from the feeling level, but that feeling level was an undefined, sub-intellectual. And when it comes to the intellectual level, it discovers it has lost its feeling. Sometimes it doesn't even like its mother. It may say, I didn't ask to be born. You paid for my education, clothing. You did it because you didn't want the neighbors to think you were a rotten mother. And so on. It will analyse all the intellectual reasons why it could be so. And in so doing, it becomes progressively colder and colder until at the term of intellectual definition, it feels completely isolated and out of relation with other beings. Now at this point, either it discovers the real meaning of feeling above the intellect, or it becomes neurotic. The object of the exercise, as we do, is to regain a feeling level, but not sub-intellectual. It must be over the intellect. We must discover that feeling is field consciousness above the intellect, but at the level of the baby, it is impulsive from genetic sources. It is heredity from a long line of developing parents, pushing their characteristics through. comes up a feeling disturbed from an impulse. As when we throw a pebble in the pond, the ripple, although it's manifesting in the pond as in the field, has actually arisen from an impact of the stone. The object of the exercises we do is to regain a feeling level, but not sub-intellectual. It must be over the intellect. We must discover that feeling is field consciousness above the intellect, but at the level of the baby it is impulsive from genetic sources. It is heredity from a long line of developing parents pushing their characteristics through. Comes up a feeling disturbed from an impulse, as when we throw a pebble in the pond, the ripple, although it's manifesting in the pond as in the field, has actually arisen from an impact of the stone. Now the characteristic impulses that come in babies come from lines of parents, because the instinct in a human baby isn't like that of a chicken. The baby doesn't, as soon as it's born, start rushing about the carpet, pecking, picking up seeds like a chicken does. So its instincts are specific, derived from particular ancestors. They're like stones thrown by the ancestors into a plasma, which then responds. And a feeling is produced by this ancestral stimulus, and that feeling is a feel state produced by a finite. It is sub-intellectual. Now above the intellect is the field itself, which actually makes the stones it has thrown. And this higher feeling, this higher field consciousness, is the one to be aimed at, because it is that higher feeling that enables you to choose the correct act in a lower situation. If you can feel at the higher level, you can anticipate what somebody at the lower level is about to do before they know about it, and you can utter a magical word which would divert their thought process, and they'd suddenly say, I was going to say something then, but it's gone. This happens mechanically all day long, but it can be done deliberately. A person is on the edge of discovering something very momentous which will drive him around the bend, and a candy word in time, and he doesn't know what he was going to say, and then he's diverted. Now the hierarchical structure of the universe is such that it has a series of veils. Salome wears them. We say that there are seven veils on the Amshin, corresponding with the meaning of the symbolism of the days of the week and the planets of the zodiac. These veils successively obscure the reality of the Amshinu, so that lower level functions will be carried on, and so that nobody from a lower level can break into a higher level prematurely. And these seven veils exist in the human being. They have their points of correspondence in the nervous system, at certain levels in the spine. They have their psychological values at the subtle level, and they have their volitional values at the causal level. They can be discovered only by progressive non-identification. The man who identifies himself with, say, the Labour Party, and thinks that anything not Labour is necessarily wrong, cannot comprehend the arguments of a Conservative, hardly at all of a Liberal. And this is because certain veils are on him in his mind, because he is not yet ready to integrate higher concepts into his lower system, because he hasn't yet cut the bottom out of his lower system by work. To get to a higher level safely, one must work on the lower level until the bottom falls out of it.
Ideas presented to you and you work with them. So this in itself must precipitate at some time a situation which is going to cause you to battle through one of those veils. Is that so?
Oh yes.
It means to say that if you're working in this way, you are in actual fact creating a situation which is going to give you the chance to either get up to a higher level through the situation establishing the concept in you, or else fall back and have to carry on the game.
Mm-hmm.
If that's so.
Yes. This means that there's a way open for you to take the veils off. That is deliberately to try to see the how, that means the mechanics, of the situational level which you then set. Try to penetrate to the how, what is working in the situation at that level. If you do so, you will cut the bottom out of it, because logic is taught logic. It goes round and round and round. At a certain point, you will see that you are defining the thing in terms of itself. And at that moment, it will simply fall through. And simultaneously, you will feel that you've not been damaged by it. And that occurs when you're on the next level. And you can't get onto a next level unless you actually work to see the truth, the mechanical how, of the situation in which you find yourself. Your desperate need is your disparate need. You see, you're working very hard before you become desperate. How can you become desperate unless you've got two disparate ideas? You've got an idea that there is something valuable, and another idea, the fact that you haven't got it. What it is, you don't know. And you struggle to get to this higher level. If you don't struggle to the point of desperation, you can't get it.
That's what I'm thinking about. For instance, we've spoken just a short time ago about Helen White being Englishman or something like that, and goes to another country. Well, to a certain extent, all people are very identified with their nationality, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And if this is suddenly swept away from them, they can, I think, have a very unhappy time of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be driven to the need for something else, and this something else can come and help them to carry on, or else they can be lost, I think.
Going native is a piece of mechanics. A man goes out from one society into another, and the stimulus situation of the previous society is absent, and the new society stimulates it and piles up. And it's simply a matter of adding impulses one on top of another until the new situation has more impulses determinant in the man than the old. And at that moment he goes native. And this is mechanics. He's identified. To become free, one must not identify with any finite. So if I want to become free from the possibility of going native, I must already be free from the idea that I'm English.
What I want to ask you is that, supposing you have been shaped in this respect, if you come to the concept of you're just a man, you can't be one thing or the other, you're a man, you've got to do it, is that a higher level than the national identification or not?
That you're just a man?
Yes.
Now, if you understand what man means and make it of values, yes. If it's simply a sound, man, no.
Well,
if you say man means a creator of values, so all the values of the Chinese and the North American Indians and the Eskimo and the Englishman and so on, they are created by act of will, by beings called man, that is value makers.
Well, what I'm thinking about, you see, is that if your idea of your nationality has been swept away from you, you're forced to go back and assess yourself, aren't you, as what you are.
Depends on the nature of your organism. If you get your nationality swept away, you may become a stateless person and just be swamped completely by multitudes of unassimilable stimuli. You may become neurotic. See, we've got to deal with concrete people. Outside this room, there are how many millions of people are there? Too many, to be able to count. Those people we can have nothing to do with at the moment. We can't do anything for them or to them, except in so far as we can modify ourselves now, here. And the concrete fact is, do I, as an individual, understand that man means a creator of values? A primary appetite, ma, is substance, M, and energy, A. emotion, M. Man is a substance actively moving. In this motion, he is creating values. He is counting man. He is enumerating. He is making value judgments. This is man. So I don't care two hoots if a man comes in and says, I am a Chinese delegate. I said, you're a man, so you are defining yourself as a Chinese delegate. I define you as a chop suey joint owner. You see? All definitions are valid to the men who make them. And the big fight in the world today, in politics, for power, in world affairs, is by men who define situations and impose their definitions on other men. This is the point. Kasavubu and Lumumba and everybody else are busy talking like mad to try to impose by turns on fellows with smaller vocabularies. That's all. And they will win, factually, because there are men with smaller vocabularies. So that individually here we have to work in a certain way. It's no good for us to say, oh, there are how many, say 600 million Chinese. We should consider them. Why should we consider them? They are making values. A long time ago, in the 5th century BC, they made values. They said, don't let's make a machine that will improve the situation, otherwise we'll find we've got a job 8 hours a day. That was their value. They had another idea. They have paid the price of that idea in lack of development. In Europe, they took the other way. Let's dig the place up and blow it up. Seize power. Suddenly they've seized responsibility. And there's always the backwash. Now they're terrified of the people who chose the other way. Because whether you choose high, low, near, far, in a non-dual absolute, you'll be driven into the opposite. If you take any kind, any one of the pair of opposites. So it is for us as individuals to find out where we stand. Or for myself as an individual to find out where I stand. And for you to find out where you stand. You have to say, do you understand that you are a man? That is a creator of values. Are the values you are creating good enough for you? Or are they values of an inferior order imposed on you by somebody else for their benefit? Cui bono? To whom the good? You've been educated. Why? When Luther opposed the Roman Church, he threw out certain beliefs. And he put in their place the religious beliefs, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Why? Simply because the business was going to expand. More people had to be able to read and write and do arithmetic. That's all. So that under the guise of religious change, factually, the ground of an industrial revolution has been there. Now, it doesn't matter that the opposite camp were equally biased in their definitions. The more intelligent one said, if you throw out that Roman dogma about works as well as faith, then people won't think they have to work. Factually, to throw it out at all is to throw men back on the Bible. And to say that men can interpret the Bible is to say that any man may think what he likes about it. Now, all men are unequal. Therefore, the thoughts about the Bible are unequal. So for one man, like Montgomery or Napoleon, the Bible is a textbook of military strategy. The battle cry of the Lord, mighty in battle. Favorite book, Joshua. For another man, it's full of pacifistic ideas. If each man interprets the Bible in his own way, in a very peculiar way, there is no Bible. Because it becomes individually, finitely subjective. There must be a level of interpretation where the most intelligent man would see its highest application. But that most intelligent man is either the cosmic intelligence itself, Christ incarnate, or at the temporal moment, now, an abstract idea that is not incarnate. not existential, not present. You are a man, therefore you create values. How do you value the Bible? How do you value the Tao Te Ching, the Yi Ching, the Bhagavad Gita, and so on? Some people throw them away, it's rubbish. The Chinese are in process, practically, of throwing away everything they've ever thought valuable, simply because of the success of heavy bombs. You see, the fact convinces, and yet it may convince wrongly. It may give a total inversion of values, which in the end may turn out to be quite false. There must come a time when intelligence will have to arrange everything without much noise, which means without big bang. Meanwhile, in the hierarchy within an individual, the individual has to do something in himself. Is he miserable? What is misery? What does it mean? It is M-I-S and it is E-R-Y. The Y at the end is a condensation, an integration of certain forces, erroneous forces, by misapprehension. You see? You misapprehend the situation, you run about, you find yourself in misery, inefficiency. If you're miserable, you're being inefficient. When you're being miserable, don't try to justify the misery. That increases the inefficiency. Just say misery arises from inefficiency. The only cause of sorrow is the realization of individual personal impotence. Accept that. Penetrate to the meaning of it. If I become dejected, it's because I couldn't handle the situation. It's myself I'm talking about. I cannot handle the situation, therefore I am miserable. Is that a good enough reason? It should be a spur to get to know more about it, to be able to handle it, and then the misery will go. And not to wish that 10,000 Eskimo should be made happy by creating an icy welfare state called charity begins at home. Home is whole, me. Behold, myself. And there is no home for anybody other than that place where he can actually say, without the police knocking on the door and locking him up, behold, myself, Lord, and my domain. That's home. And the more abstractly you talk about the work that might be done by other people not present, the more time that is wasted. The more we can persuade ourselves that there is work to be done now in us, here, and the here is always HR, where that power differentiates itself, creating a now, right on the moment, immediately, that the more rapidly we transcend the lower level. It is done by energy being inserted from above. The energy scatters the situation, dissembles it, breaks it up, disintegrates it, blows it to blazes, destroys your then security, and leaves you looking at the bits. But it's you looking at the bits. You've not been blown to bits, the bits have been blown. And it's this realization that whatever concept is broken to bits, you were untouched. The other day I was talking to a gentleman who was about to leave home, leave his wife. He had a very, very long face. And I said to him, "You're very, very sad." He said, "I am. I'm wondering if I did the right thing. What do you think?" And I said, "I'm thinking that this house hasn't got central heating in it." You know, his own house is very big, very posh, and centrally heated. It's October, nearly. Suddenly there's a nip in the air. Is it correct to rush out at this time of the year to freedom, into a non-centrally heated house with a gap that big under the door? You see? And he thought he was thinking morally, but really there was no central heating. And it was as simple as that. And there are more men get driven back by the need for warmth than there are by ethical considerations. And the ability to penetrate in your own mind into your own motive and to know that the consciousness in which you absolutely are not different cannot in any way be destroyed. No matter what else is destroyed, that cannot be. And the Bhagavad Gita says, flames cannot burn it, swords cannot cut it. He's talking about the continuum. The stuff that I'm wagging my hand in now, which you can't see. But my hand is the modality of it. The sentience in myself doesn't belong to the body. It has created the body. If that attention withdraws, sentience is withdrawn with it, and anesthesia results. If I identify too closely, I get a pain. If you look at me. So let's focus, as far as possible, on ourselves as individuals. See what work we've got to do, and know what the work is. The work is always to take the level that we believe to be valid, and deliberately try to work it out. Make ourselves think our position out, clearly, to its logical end, and it will cut a hole in us. And then the bottom will drop out of that world, and there'll be a hole we can look through. Nice free hole. And through that hole will come grace, spirit. But not if we don't carve it by work. Remember, inertia would make us very comfortable. If we can get the body adjusted in temperature, adjusted with input of food and output of excrement and so on, if we can balance it in perfect equilibrium, big if we could, we wouldn't need philosophy, we wouldn't need anything, because we would be totally unaware of any event whatever. An event is already a sign of a disequilibrium in this absolute force. So that perfect equilibrium would be the same as non-existence. And yet men try to get it. They're trying to get it when they try to balance the body temperatures by going home and they've had a row and it's getting nippy. If ever they get it, they are dead. The thing is to abandon the pursuit of equilibrium as comfort. And instead of that, penetrate to the meaning of everything you do in order to understand yourself. To see what your potentialities are, to bring them into actuality, to discover every aspect of your own being, in every situation, to make that the aim.
I've noticed that most people appear to circumscribe their lives to a great extent, gradually getting smaller and smaller and drive themselves towards comfort. But they appear to still have extremes of emotional change in relation to very small situations, smaller and smaller situations. They get really bothered about very little things on the driving themselves away from the place of fear that sort of thing.
Can you see why that should be so? Mechanical.
The only thing I can think is that they still have to utilise their energy they have.
Mm-hmm. They have a certain amount of energy derived from food, cosmic radiation, all sorts of sources. If they have a very large field of interest, the energy pans out over a large area. If they cut it down and start pursuing domestic bourgeois equilibrium, the smaller the circle, the more work that energy does within it. It must start niggling. It must move towards internal disintegration, towards neurosis. So the man of very, very wide interest is free from this problem. And the man of no interest, like a village idiot, is free from that problem. But the man who deliberately pursues a finite, closed security is really circumscribing his own energies and forcing them within that circumscription to cut into bits. So we know exactly where to look for our best psychiatric patients. Namely, in the field where people pursue finite security. Because their own energies are cutting into bits. So if I were a psychiatrist and I wanted to stay in business a long time, I would actually encourage people to pursue finite security, knowing that their own energies would make them uncomfortable within it. and then have to come and find out why.
When you were speaking earlier on about developing the concepts all the time so that you have a clear view of everything, and this concept of making it clear in the process is making you less emotional about it, is the exercise of seeing what is in the space in between developing that feeling at the same time as you're conceptually working on it.
It must be, because relation is between. If you were to concentrate on that which is totally X, with nothing other than X, you would become monoideistic. Your mind would set in the one form, and relation would cease. If you get two things and then look between them to see their relation, you are forcing yourself to become field conscious. Supposing you're in conversation with somebody, you're a man, supposing you're talking to a woman, and she wiggles her eyebrow in a certain way. Now, supposing you try to think of the relation between that wiggle of the eyebrow and the immediate stimulus that hits her at the point of wiggle. In other words, you may have said something, or a car may have gone by, and at that moment, her eyebrow wiggled. You're going to try to find the relation between these things. See if you can discover whether it was merely a coincidence, or whether there was a thought process of her own that caused it, irrelevant to the external situation, or whether you caused it, and so on. Work the mind to see if you can feel the relation between these different phenomena. In so doing, you sharpen field consciousness, and then you discover that the space between is full of form that you didn't previously notice. Just as between the two walls of this room, with the appropriate apparatus, we could show that sound is reflecting across it in a certain formal manner. So that what is apparently an empty space is really full of form. If we look at that light and then focus the eye not on the light, it's a little nearer, and look very carefully at the air, then we'll see certain motions that we were not aware of beforehand. It's this betweenness that confers understanding, because betweenness is the key to relation. And if all the time you make yourself seek for the betweenness, that is between two terms, you become progressively not identified with the terms, but with the field. The formal content of the field then confers ideas of the relation. Now again, you may just say, yes, that's a good idea, and forget all about it. The thing has to be made practical. It has to be put into practice. Even better, it must be put into practice.
Well, it immediately occurs to me, in that case, if you want to withdraw yourself from the situation, you merely to conceptualize it, so if you want to go in, you really start to work on the space principle.
Mm-hmm. Remember the ace in space means spirit. When you're trying to become space conscious, at the level of Einstein's physics, you're trying to become aware of the unifield. If you actually believe that there is a force there, you begin to become conscious of it. The gross materialist, and there are gross materialists in the world, exist who would deny that there is anything between that wall and that. And if you said, well, they're there between them, they say, oh yes, but you can't count air. If you said, well, there's not only air between, but that wall and that wall are really made of electrical charges. There is a field here. Well, you can't count a field. You see, if he's biased in a certain way, he will disallow anything whatever determinant between these two walls. And yet we know, as a fact, and could register with the appropriate instruments, all sorts of electrical and other phenomena between these two walls. If we become aware of them, we can begin to devise an instrument for perceiving them. We already have an instrument that can perceive them, namely our physical organ. If we become aware of the possibility of it, if we lie on a bed in a dark room and say, my sense of feeling is not confined to the surface of my skin, I can actually feel the whole room, and then try to feel it, apart from feeling a bit scared, which is very frequent first result, you'll find that you can feel it, that you're aware of the densities within the room where pieces of furniture are. And furthermore, you will increase your sense, perceptual power, your hearing will become more sensitive, and so on. You become more light sensitive. You become aware that you are able to see things with your eyes closed. Probably something like a blind person is aware roughly of the shapes of things. You know, some congenitally blind people can tell you the height of a building. Some do it by listening to characteristic motions in the air, and some actually immediately feeling it. Some can walk about in a dark room without banging into furniture and without touching it. This is simply awareness of characteristic motions emanating from those objects. This kind of thing the human body has already. We used to have it in the stage called Adamic, pre-fall. The human being had it. He could feel through any so-called solid and be aware, cognize what was on the other side. By concentration on the gross material world, we have fallen. By concentration on the gross material world, a whole host of forces lapsed in consciousness, and then they had to be very painfully discovered over a few thousand years by science. So Einstein's unifield was actually experienced by men thousands of years ago as an immediate fact, that the place where a body is has peculiar forces which are highly curved where space concentrations occur, and that the sensitive man can feel those bodies in space by what would be equivalent to the curvature of that space, the curved dynamism, the modal behaviour of space around that object would bring to consciousness the object. Now it is by concentration on the gross material world, by banging the hardest parts of the body, the bones, against the gross material objects in the world, that consciousness began to identify with the gross body. Once it had done so, it had gained a point. It had gained freedom from magic. And you know, the early church believed in magic. And there are examples in the Bible of magic. And this magic was deliberately, by the church, gradually denied, said to be non-existent. Because when people believed in it, it worked. Because they were aware of the will and intention of other people. They could feel goodwill, they could feel badwill. And therefore there was a perpetual panic, and a wearing of symbols and totems and defensive talismans. You see? And a running to the priest for protection against a man with a strong evil eye. By teaching that the gross world was the only world that existed, then all the panicking people gradually began to scoff at these forces. They became unconscious. They're still there. They're still determined. And now people don't believe in them, officially. But you'll find that the slightest scare, and they do believe in them. And as soon as they're scared, they begin to operate. And you can see why a veil is on. Why a veil is over the world of will, which could change everything immediately. Because people have no self-control. When they have no self-control, they have no defense against the volitional intention of other beings. But if we can train them to believe in the gross material world, the stone rejected by the builders, then we can focus their attention so that everything else goes out of tune. They become totally ignorant of a world of subtle and causal forces, and they can then no longer operate them. And so a kind of social material stability is conferred by this deliberate teaching by the church that these forces don't exist anymore. But that stability destroys the very ground of relation. Because once you focus people on the gross material world then becomes their treasure. Where the heart is, there is the treasure also. Then they begin to fight for possession of the gross material world, and it doesn't matter anymore that the subtle forces that might have harmed them are no longer in consciousness, because now gross forces harm them. to the dialectic sense of things. So then they must regain this higher sensitivity that there is magic, plus self-determination, the conscious realization that man is a creator of values. And if somebody tries to make bad magic on me, I say, I also am a man. I make a good magic. I'll go further. I even forgive you your attempt at bad magic. Because I know that the concept of my forgiving you is more powerful than your intention to harm me. So I can actually affect you with my intent to forgive you for your black magic more powerfully than you can affect me. So my white magic is better than your black magic. And the pursuit of efficiency alone would make me prefer to be a white magician rather than a black one. Because forgiveness is more powerful than revenge and enmity. It is actually more powerful to forgive. Because it releases more energy. When you revenge, you contract. In so doing, you find out your own energy, like the pursuit of comfort does to you. So the black magician, concentrating on his individual private purpose, is tightening energies in himself, which will disintegrate him. But the man who doesn't want any revenge can relax. His energies can operate easily, freely, and more effectively. Because then he's functioning at a higher frequency. Of course they are. Remember the fact, well, it's only a few years ago, that there was a little outbreak of black magic in a certain village. Just one man was supposed to have overlooked somebody's cow and turned the milk sour. Somebody said so, somebody believed it. And immediately, everybody in that locality began to have trouble. And if the bee could not come down with a heavy hammer and said there's no such thing as witchcraft, it would have spread very rapidly throughout the country. Now, either that bee was intelligent and knew that there was such a thing, but it wasn't expedient to say so, or he himself was a victim of the gross material education. The point was that as soon as one case was raised, sensitivity in people increased. The gross material world is not the thing they concentrated on anymore. Suddenly they concentrated on the feelings emanating from people. Has she got the evil eye? Has he got it? Has he lent it to him? And so on. As soon as you let go of the gross material world, if you haven't got reflexive self-consciousness, you're at the mercy of the forces between gross bodies. And therefore, gross materialism is a protection for non-self-conscious reflexive beings.
Well, that appears to me as though if you're putting yourself in constant danger by attempting to develop.
Well, we hope so. You see, to avoid danger, absolutely the only safe way is to be dead. Because life is change, and the ANG in change means fear, angst, anxiety, anger. So if there's any change at all, it disturbs an equilibrium. Anybody identified with the equilibrium is going to be thrown into a state of anxiety and fear. And the alternative to it, if you don't like it, is death. Just don't exist. The thing is to recognize this and not to identify with an equilibrium. Identify with the absolute dynamism, which never for a moment of time does two things identically. So it is essentially insecure, that is, internally secure. It is the creator of its own motions. The motions are not imposed on it from without. There is no without. The impulsions are generated, the impulsions, the impulses, generate their own motions. They are self-generated. There's nothing to be afraid of. It is you who impose on yourself. Has somebody got the evil eye? They come to you and point it at you. Do you believe it? He is a man who is saying, as man, evaluator, I have an evil eye. You are another man. Do you accept his evaluation? If so, you're a bad evaluator. You will go down, that's certain. So you have to decide whether you're going to evaluate properly or not. If you do, you can say, you've got an evil eye, you say. So what? What are you going to do about it? Have you seen a doctor? So, you can completely disarm it by re-evaluating the situation. And if you can't, you'll go under to him, that's certain. Because there's a hierarchy of power.
If forgiveness is greater than a feeling of revenge, how can a person feeling forgiveness help release the person feeling revenge from the effects of their thought process?
By a large amount of patience. Because one of the first things that happens is you start forgiving a person who isn't forgiving you. Then, really, for the time being, the amount of energy that they had ready to hit you with if you didn't forgive them, you're looking for a target. If it doesn't find one in you, it must start working in them. This is why Kurt says, you will heap coals of fire upon their head. Which means that the brain gets on fire. Because it's got to devise a method of reducing you to the level of enmity. You see? If it does, it has won. You're no good. You only said you were. I win my point by reducing you to an enemy level. And if you're tremendously patient, you can, after the coals of fire have burned a hole in my brain, still talk to me. And rather than lose face, I must accept your friendship. It just takes a bit of time. The tendency is when you forgive somebody who's not forgiving you, is that they know what you're doing, they're fully sort of forgiving them. So they work like mad to unseat you, to provoke you, to anger, to revenge. And as soon as you lash out, they smile quietly. They gain their point. Because they know underneath that if you'd remain at that high level, they'd have to give in. And that they don't want to do because of their egotism. So you have to persist in forgiving and not make the forgiving into a weapon. Actually, to concentrate and say, this person is in a dark hell. Their brain is overheated, seeking methods to unseat me, poor dear. See? And not to condemn this seeking of the method because it is volitional mechanical. It is mechanical, determined by the stimulus situation. But there is a will behind it to gain the ascendancy of it. But it is certain that if you don't lose, it will have to parley with you. And if you do lose, it will jump on you. So you have your choice. It requires a terrific amount of patience and a continuous regaining of the patience you've just lost, which you told yourself you were going to keep.